It was September 11th, 1985 at Riverfront Stadium.
A standing room only crowd in Cincinnati on its feet. First inning, Pete Rose against Eric Schau.
Pete Rose stood at first base and cried when he surpassed Ty Cobb that night.
Everybody on their feet here in Cincinnati and a worldwide television audience watching these moments tonight here at Riverfront Stadium. 2-1 pitch from Schau in the left center. There it is. Rose has eclipsed Cobb. That's number 4,192.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today, we're going to talk about the player who Keith O'Brien calls both a miracle and a disaster. O'Brien starts his new book about Pete Rose, explaining he grew up in Cincinnati when the baseball legend was at the peak of his fame. O'Brien chronicles the good, the bad, and the ugly in his new book called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the book and the man whose story it tells, our author, Keith O'Brien. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
And WVXU senior political analyst, Howard Wilkinson. Howard covered Rose's court cases for The Enquirer. Thanks for being here, Howard.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Keith, tell us about the relationship Pete Rose had with his father and how that shaped him and his approach to life and how he played baseball.
Sure. So Pete grows up on the west side of Cincinnati, as many folks know. And the original star, athletic star in the Rose family was his father, Harry Francis Rose, or better known on the west side as Big Pete. In the 1930s, 40s, and even in the 1950s, Big Pete was a semi-pro football player on the west side, and that was as far as he could go. These are the days before the Cincinnati Bengals. So from the moment that his first son is born in April 1941, the father fixates on his success and really drives him. And you know, we've seen this story over the years with athletes in particular. And sometimes, you know, the boy ends up rejecting or rebelling against the father's message. But that does not happen in the case of Pete Rose. He really does absorb what his father is telling him. He wants to please his father. And he knows his father is right about one thing. You know, Big Pete is always telling the boy that he needs to hustle, that he needs to work hard. And little Pete knows that, too. Because one thing that I learned in the reporting of my book, I think would surprise most people, is that Pete Rose, one of our most iconic baseball players, is never the best player on his own youth baseball teams on the West Side, is never the best baseball player on his high school teams at Western Hills. He's a smaller boy. He's undersized. Frankly, he lacks a lot of athleticism and talent. And so he knows from a young age that he's going to need to hustle in order to make it, and that's what he'll do.
Hmm. Howard, Pete was known as a player who loved talking to reporters. Mm-hmm. Do you think that prevented sports reporters, especially in his earlier days in his career, from really digging into the rumors about him once they started? Did that serve him well for many years?
Yeah, I think it did. And he, you know, he began his professional career in the 1960s. And in those days, that was not something that baseball writers were writing about. And plus, he was a great interview. And I'm from personal experience. I mean, the guy would talk to you anytime, anywhere. And you get done talking to him, and he would look at you and say, "You got any more?" And he'd say, "No, that's okay, Pete." You know,
yeah.
But yeah, that was part of it—his accessibility and the time in which he came up.
Sure, Keith, talk about some of the bad behavior that went unchecked by baseball beat reporters for so many years.
So we all know that Pete Rose is going to be banned from baseball for life in August 1989 for gambling on the Reds and gambling on baseball games. And, you know, we'd be inclined to think, well, this is a mistake that maybe was just made a couple years earlier or a year earlier, et cetera. And that's just not the case at all. You know, his bad behavior, to use your term, really goes back a couple decades. And when you look at it as I have in my book, you see that it's really almost like a freight train a-coming. You know, this is a problem that is looming for decades. And it's for starters, a problem of gambling. You know, as early as the late 1960s, people are concerned in Cincinnati that young Pete Rose, a star for the Reds, is spending way too much time at the racetrack at River Downs. Indeed, some people write letters to the editor of the local newspapers questioning why Rose is, you know, going to the racetrack in the afternoon before he reports to the ballpark. By the early 1970s, based on my reporting, Pete Rose is already betting with bookies on sports. The good news for Pete is that the bookies at those times were friendly to him. They were local guys, West Side guys. They were going to protect Pete Rose, and they do. But by the mid-1970s, Pete Rose's gambling is an open secret in the Reds locker room. It's a concern for his teammates. And again, based on my reporting, by 1978, a full 11 years before he's banned from baseball, there is some kind of secret meeting that happens in the office of Reds president Dick Wagner, a meeting that includes Wagner, Rose, and the head of security for Major League Baseball. And the conversation that day is about gambling, bookies, and debts to bookies. So it's known, it's out there, even Major League Baseball is aware of it, and nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody will write about it, and it remains a secret until it isn't anymore.
Keith, you write in your book about Pete's early memories of going to the horse track with his dad and why he enjoyed that so much. I mean, I believe you wrote about how that was one time that his dad wasn't pushing him to practice or play. He could just be with his dad. Talk about that. Do you think that's part of, you know, at the root of this interest he had in gambling?
You know, part of your job as a journalist or as a nonfiction writer is to try to understand your subject, understand his or her motivations. And I do think it's notable that in my 27 hours of recorded interviews with Pete Rose, the kind of access he's never granted before to any other author, that Pete told me that his fondest memories of his childhood are spending those days at the racetrack with his dad down at River Downs. You know, it's not playing baseball, you know, on the West Side. It's not playing football and baseball at Western Hills High School. It's going to the racetrack with his dad and standing on the rails and cheering on his daddy's horse. And, you know, we can all play dime store, you know, psychologist with Pete Rose. But I do think that that says something about him. And I do think that that memory and those, you know, the fondness he had of those times at the track is the kind of thing that would push a man to go back to the track. And that's what Pete Rose does.
We're talking in this recorded interview about legendary baseball player Pete Rose and his new book about him called Charlie Hustle. Keith, we were talking about this friendly media coverage that Pete Rose got for so many years, especially earlier in his career. And that really changed with a Sports Illustrated story that was supposed to be much bigger than what the magazine ended up publishing. Do you see that as kind of the beginning of the end for Pete Rose?
Well, it is ultimately that. In February 1989, just days before spring training opens down in Florida, Major League Baseball catches the whiff of a rumor that Sports Illustrated is investigating a tip that Pete has been betting on baseball and betting on the Reds. And what they do at that point is significant. Outgoing Commissioner Peter Ueberroth, incoming Commissioner Bart Giamatti, and then National League President and Giamatti's right-hand man, Faye Vincent, call Pete Rose to New York for a secret meeting, in which they ask him point blank, is it true? Are you betting on baseball? Have you bet on the Reds? And Pete tells them that day, no. In fact, what he says, according to Faye Vincent, is that he wouldn't be that stupid as to bet on baseball. I mean, every baseball player, and certainly a longtime player like Pete Rose, knew the rule that if you bet on the game, you faced lifetime banishment. And when Pete leaves that day, the men in the room believed him. He was believable. But with Sports Illustrated circling, Faye Vinson and Bart Giamatti knew that they couldn't sit on their hands and take Pete Rose's word for it. They had to dig into it to themselves. And that's what they do. They hire a special investigator outside of the Office of Major League Baseball, a man named John Dowd, who is a former Justice Department investigator and prosecutor, to see what he can find out about Rose's gambling. And this is really where it all begins to unravel on Pete Rose. And that investigation, led by John Dowd, will dig up in a matter of just 8 to 10 weeks, years and years of lies, years and years of Pete's gambling that he's been trying to hide from all of us.
Howard Pete continued to play after that Sports Illustrated article. He worked as a player manager for the Reds. Do you think the average fan really cared about the negativity that started swirling around him at that point?
Well, most Reds fans did not. There were a significant number of them who did. And they seemed to take the attitude that, well, that's just Pete. That's just the way Pete is. Well, it was more than that. Keith is right. I mean, the minute that John Dowd walked into this situation, Pete Rose was done. You could stick a fork in him because John Dowd didn't care. I mean, he would just go out and he was going to document everything, and he did.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. And later in the program, we'll hear about the role hedge funds have played in the newspaper industry. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We continue our recorded conversation about the legendary baseball player Pete Rose and a new book about him called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. My guests are author Keith O'Brien and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson, who covered Rose's court cases for The Inquirer. Keith, your book tells the stories of so many people who surrounded Pete Rose, who loved him and supported him, including a number of people who helped him feed his worst impulses. Are any of those people in your book, do you view them as heroes? Do you see them as victims? How do you see them after all this research?
Yeah, so I tried to interview anyone who crossed paths in a significant way with Pete Rose in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And obviously, I wanted to interview the people in his inner circle, the men who placed his bets on sports with bookies, the men who placed his bets on baseball. And I did ultimately interview three different men who placed those bets. And, in 1989, 35 years ago, when this story was breaking, right about this time in the summer of 89, there was an inclination among the press to paint those men as lackeys, hangers-on, oftentimes, pejorative terms, insulting terms were used to describe them. And that became sort of the prevailing narrative that these men sort of brought down Pete Rose. And frankly, I see it in the reverse. These were men who were, all of them, younger than Pete. And like a lot of people in Cincinnati in the 1970s and 80s, they were enamored with Pete and enamored with his fame. And what would a young man do when they'd be brought in and sort of brought into the fold and made a good friend of Pete Rose? Of course, they would do what he wanted them to do. And so, because I had the opportunity to interview those men, spend time with those men, even, sit in the living rooms of their homes today with those men, I see it differently. If I were to put a term on it, I would see them as victims here. They were caught by the gravitational pull of Pete Rose. They were sucked in. They were willing to do what he wanted. And most of those men paid their own grave prices for those choices, in criminal court.
Howard, the book, I want to back up a little bit to some more of the glory days of mm-hmm. Pete Rose. The book chronicles his personal problems, all as he was working to break Ty Cobb's all-time hit record. You were there for the games that led up to that moment, the yes. game in Cincinnati where it happened. Tell mm-hmm. us about that moment. What was it like to just be there?
Well, that was obviously electric. I mean, it was just incredible. The place was full of people. I was kind of focused because I had to write on a very tight deadline. But actually, the Sunday before that in Chicago, when he tied Pete Rose's record, was even more dramatic.
He tied Ty Cobb's record.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. And when he tied the record, that was really drama because of the rain delay and everybody, Marge Schott's going crazy back in Cincinnati, hoping that he doesn't get another at bat. And finally he did, and he ended up walking. And I mean, it was almost dark because this is before Wrigley Field had lights.
Yeah, she wanted that hit. She wanted it to happen in Cincinnati.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And she got her wish. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the whole thing, I was with the team for 2 weeks leading up to the record-breaking hit. And it was quite an experience.
I bet. Keith, you're a Reds fan too. How old were you when that happened? What kind of impression did that make on you, that you know, 4,192nd hit?
Sure. I mean, I was 12 years old that night. And I remember exactly where I was. I was standing in front of the television with my father in the living room of our house there in Cincinnati. You know, we were standing because no one, as Howard just pointed out, was sitting in that moment. I think it's a moment that's almost hard to imagine today if you didn't live through it. I mean, really, the world almost stopped that night, not just in Cincinnati, but across America. You know, the networks broke into regularly scheduled programming to carry Pete's at bat against Eric Schau live. Like when he gets the hit, a low looping line drive to left center field, the crowd at Riverfront Stadium gives him a standing ovation that lasts for 7 minutes. It lasts for so long that Pete Rose ultimately does what you mentioned at the outset, Lucy. He breaks down. He begins to cry. He can't believe that the people are still cheering for him like this. And I think it captures so much. I think it captures, for starters, how big a place baseball had in the American consciousness in 1985. And I think it also captures just how important Pete Rose was. And again, not just in Cincinnati. You know, Pete exemplified, I think, the American dream. You know, that story that we tell about Pete Rose, that he worked hard, that he hustled, and that's how he you know, got to the mountaintop. That is the American story. If you work hard, if you dedicate yourself, if you hustle, you can do anything. That's our story. We saw it in Pete Rose. And I think in a great many ways, that's why we as baseball fans cheered for Pete Rose. Mm.
You know, that was 1985, as you mentioned. Just a few years later, the Sports Illustrated article comes out, the investigation starts, things really start to fall apart for Pete. But Keith, you know, there's so much wonderful writing in your book. One of my favorite lines comes in chapter 59. You wrote, "Instead of coming to Jesus, they were going to war." Explain what you're talking about just briefly. I mean, Pete wasn't going to take this lying down, right?
Yeah, by April 1989, John Dowd, the lead investigator for Major League Baseball, has a dossier of information on Pete that is a stunningly accurate first draft of history. He has depositions with men who have placed Pete's bets on baseball. He has a deposition with a bookie south of Dayton who says he's accepted those bets on baseball. He has phone records. He has bank records. He has canceled checks. He has an incredible mountain of information that suggests very strongly that Pete Rose has been betting on baseball and has been doing it since 1987 at a minimum. And yet, in the face of all of this black and white evidence, you know, Pete Rose does probably the opposite of what he should do. He decides to drag Major League Baseball and Bart Giamatti into court, fighting them over their authority to ban him or to investigate him. and what he should have done at that point, frankly, Lucy, is come clean. And I think if he does so, the entire narrative is different. And that's not my opinion. You know, my reporting shows that if Pete Rose is honest in the spring of 1989 and tells baseball what is true, which is that, yes, he has been betting on baseball, and yes, he has been betting on the Reds, and yes, he has a problem, he has an addiction, I think the entire story is different.
And Keith, you mentioned that you interviewed Pete Rose for hours for this book. I think you said 27 hours. Why do you think he stopped cooperating? Why did he stop talking to you? Was it the questions you were asking him?
You know, I got access to Pete Rose most likely because of my Cincinnati roots. You know, my roots in Cincinnati, my connections there helped open those doors and got me, you know, into a room with Pete Rose for many days. And I don't know what happened, to answer your question, Lucy. We never had a falling out. We didn't have a crossword. We didn't have an argument. But I was pushing Pete. You know, I was pushing him to explain what happened here. And I think that's important. You know, I think one reason why we as baseball fans and we as Cincinnatians are still wrestling with the Pete Rose story 35 years later is because it doesn't make sense and it doesn't have closure. And I was trying to get Pete to reckon with it in ways he hadn't before. And I will say, to Pete's credit, he did that. I mean, he has talked to me about things that he's never spoken about before. But I think in the end, I pushed him, frankly, as far as he was willing to go.
This book raises the question of whether you can separate people from their accomplishments. That comes up with athletes, with singers, with artists, people who do amazing things but have, these terrible personal lives. Howard, how do you reconcile that question when it comes to Pete Rose? Do you think he should be in the Hall of Fame for, you know, the amazing things he did on the field?
Well, no, I don't. I really don't think the Hall of Fame is an option at this point. Keith is exactly right. I've been told by somebody who had really good firsthand knowledge of this that if Pete Rose had told Bart Giamatti, yes, I did this, I apologize to the fans, I apologize to the city, I apologize to Major League Baseball, and I was wrong, he would have gotten off with a one-year suspension, and then he would have been free to find a job in baseball. Somebody would hire him, and by now he would be in the Hall of Fame. But instead, for almost a quarter of a century, he lied about it, and he continued to lie. And when he stopped lying about it, one of his ways of apologizing was charging his fans $100 for him to sign a baseball saying, I am sorry, I bet on baseball, Pete Rose. Hmm. It cost $100 to get an apology from him to the fans, the people that loved him. I just can't even imagine how you can accept that kind of attitude.
Yeah. And Keith, real quickly, do you think he should be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, to be clear, my book is not there to make an argument for Pete Rose. It's not there to make an argument against Pete Rose. I wanted to look at his story through the prism of history, tell that story with granular reporting, let people come to their own conclusions. That's what I think I've done with the book. But of course, as a baseball fan and as a Cincinnatian, I have opinions on it personally. And my opinion, frankly, is this. I think we've lost perspective on how we honor our athletic icons. We like to put them on pedestals and ascribe to them moral values that they may or may not deserve, that they may or may not have. And so for those reasons, I believe that when it comes to Pete Rose and to all of baseball's other ne'er-do-wells, and by that I mean the steroid users, I think we should either enshrine them or not enshrine them based on what they did on the field. It is the only thing we truly know for sure. The fact is, we don't know what we don't know about our athletic icons. And so I believe we should enshrine them if what they did on the field was enough. And then if their mistakes off the field are so egregious, let's enshrine those too. In the plaque at Cooperstown, let's put those mistakes on the plaque for perpetuity right next to their accomplishments.
Well, I've been talking with author Keith O'Brien and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Keith is the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, The Last Glory Days of Baseball. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, we'll discuss the role that hedge funds have played in the newspaper industry. This is Cincinnati Edition.